This is the IBJ Podcast.
For the week of March 18th, 2024, brought to you by Taft. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. In my best FM radio voice, I'll tell you we just heard Rainy Days and Mondays, a hit in 1971 for Karen and Richard Carpenter, known, of course, as The Carpenters. The brother-sister duo helped define pop music in the 1970s with gold-gilded melodies, pristine production, and a certain yen for heartache. The performers we just heard are not The Carpenters. That performance comes from a new cabaret show that was developed in Indianapolis with a strong connection to Ball State University. It since has been performed on Broadway's doorstep in New York City. The most recent production was less than 2 weeks ago at the Laurie Beachman Theater on 42nd Street. Titled The Carpenters Project, An Offering, the show is the product of two performers who cut their teeth on stage in central Indiana. One of them you very likely have seen, Brent Marty, the director of music and education at Booth Tarkenton Civic Theater in Carmel, who performs all around the Indy area. His partner in the production is Amy Raffa, a performer, producer, and arts and not-for-profit administrator based in New York City. The two of them met in Ball State's Department of Theater and Dance in the 1990s and have been friends ever since. Their mutual love of The Carpenters led them over several years to develop the show, which is more of an exploration and celebration of the music than an impersonation. By the same token, this episode of the IBJ Podcast is about more than two people putting on a show. It's also about how young performers in theater have to hustle and sacrifice to build careers, and how they constantly face the question of whether performing exacts too high a price. It's about opportunities for collaboration, particularly in Indiana's close-knit theater community. And it's about preserving the bonds of friendship and helping each other achieve dreams together. A bit further into the podcast, we'll hear Marty and Raffa sing The Carpenters' hit Superstar. But here's the beginning of our conversation. It's my pleasure to welcome to the podcast Brent Marty, Director of Music and Education at Booth Tarkenton Civic Theater in Carmel. Brent is zooming in from Carmel. Thanks for making the time, Brent.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we're joined by Amy Raffa, a performer, producer, and arts and not-for-profit administrator based in New York City. And she's zooming in today from the Big Apple. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mason. Thrilled to be here.
So strictly on a personal note, I wanted to thank you guys for bringing the spotlight back to this music. I think it's fair to say that the three of us are more or less children of the 70s. Now, some of the music from the 70s has come back over the years and has a whole new life in popular culture, but I haven't seen that with the Carpenters so much. Is that consistent with your experience, or have you seen something different?
For me, I see things like there are Facebook groups galore devoted to these, and they have a huge international presence. So it's not necessarily maybe here in the US, but abroad, they are still very popular. And I haven't run into anyone yet who, even younger people, when I say our show features the catalog of the Carpenters, oh, I love the Carpenters. Nobody ever has said, ooh, Carpenters. So it's very reassuring. And I think you're right. There's something about that swinging back around a little bit.
But similarly to Brent, when I tell folks that, you know, we have the show celebrating the Carpenters, same thing. Oh my gosh, I love the Carpenters. Oh my gosh, my parents listened to the Carpenters. Oh my gosh, that brings back so many memories. So this period, perhaps we've hit on a bit of nostalgia for folks our age and older that it's bringing back. And as a matter of fact, I have a, without going on and on about it, we did the show last year in Chicago at Davenport's, which is a very popular cabaret venue there. And a friend of mine's husband was there. And he said afterwards, I listened to this music in the car with my aunt. She played it every time we were in the car. He said, I have very distinct memories of every single song you sang, some of the stories you told that seem sort of deep dives. He said, I know all of that, and everything, all of that came rushing back to me.
Now, how many times have you performed The Carpenters Project and Offering at this point?
Well, since its premiere at the Cabaret in Indianapolis, which was 2022, we did that. We've done it at Fine Science here in Carmel. We did it at Davenport's in Chicago. We did it at Don't Tell Mama in New York. And we did it at the Laurie Beachman Theater in New York. Mm-hmm. So is that it? That's fine?
Yeah. We did it also at the Paramount Theater in Anderson.
You played Anderson.
The folks at the Paramount Theater were trying some new event ideas. And so they created a whole cabaret setting in the ballroom there. And I think it was a very successful event. So
we love it.
Love it. And we can, I mean, it is designed for cabaret, but it doesn't necessarily have to be in a traditional, you know, cabaret venue. I mean, we can do it in a bar. We could do it in a ballroom that's set up. We can really go anywhere with it.
So the most recent show was March 7th at the Laurie Beachman Theater. That's on 42nd Street, right, in Manhattan. I mean, you're a T-shot away from Broadway. Walk me through the show. At the beginning, does somebody introduce you and call you up to the stage? Are you already there? I mean, what is the first stuff that the audience experiences?
Exactly. Usually there is an announcement of some kind, either from sometimes it's just the sound person or it's the host at the venue. And they introduce us and we come zooming up the stage to thunderous applause. What I have said to Amy is, you know, every time we've done this show, it's kind of been in front of friendly audiences because we know people around in these cities where we've played. And there's a lot of Ball State connection. We are both graduates of the Department of Theater and Dance at Ball State, very proud alum. And, you know, there's a little following there. So we play in front of very friendly houses most of the time so far. I'm ready to take it out to the West Coast and just see what happens.
I want to make sure people understand you're not impersonating Karen and Richard Carpenter. Like, the way I understand it, you're using the music of the Carpenters as a kind of lens. We're talking about memories of growing up, of becoming adults, and different issues in your lives. Is that right?
Yeah. For listeners who may not know what cabaret is, you know, it's a specific live performance art form that wraps music and storytelling. And what makes cabaret special is the personal connection that the artist is bringing to the music and the storytelling. So our celebration of Carpenters is going to be very different from somebody else who may have a connection to Carpenters. And with cabaret, you're weaving in stories either about the artist and the music or your personal connection to them in with the music. So for our celebration of Carpenters, it's not an impersonation. I'm not pretending to be Karen. Brent isn't pretending to be Richard. Though I am an alto, I have the same vocal range as Karen Carpenter. I'm not trying to sound like her. And there are tribute bands out there. They're called tribute bands. Those folks do try to sound and emulate the artist. You know, there's many tribute bands out there for all kinds of artists. And I think that there may be Carpenters tribute bands. And those folks are really trying to emulate that sound. We are bringing our memories, our feelings about the music, and those stories about how the music has affected us and affected audiences. We're weaving that in with us singing the songs. So it's a celebration of their music.
So you just had the show. I mean, it was almost a week ago. While we're still talking about it, let me ask, was there anything that stood out about that particular show? I mean, maybe the fifth time you've done it, like you say, I mean, the form is supposed to be loose. There's supposed to be a sense of freedom about it. And you can make new discoveries about the music, like in real time. And the audience can be affected in a different way than a previous audience was. Was there anything that really stood out?
Every venue is a little different. So even when we're performing the same set or the same show as we have it written, we make adjustments as we go. So there was some rearranging of staging. It happened to be the same week that it's always about the Ball State connection, that the Ball State senior musical theater class was in town to do their showcase, which includes one of our backup singers. So we actually were able to bring him up for one number that we do. And the reaction is always great. But this was a special one because of that connection. And I did find out after the show that actually Billy Stritch was in the audience. And if you don't know who Billy Stritch is, talk about an amazing, genius, talented pianist and singer and cabaret artist. I'm glad I didn't know before.
Yeah, real point.
Billy certainly has worked with all of the greats. The other thing I would say in terms of, you know, what happens in the moment, and this is another piece that I think makes cabaret special, because everybody's so close and you're in a smaller setting, you can hear people go, oh, or you can hear somebody, when we're telling perhaps a particular story about a certain song, you can hear the audible acknowledgement from the audience. And it's okay, it's accepted, and in fact encouraged in the cabaret setting to acknowledge that. Oh, yes, right, that seems to have really moved you. We feel the same way. Or, oh, we heard somebody ooh and ah there in the back. You know, we're with you.
So what are your first memories of seeing or hearing the Carpenters? And I'm going to insert myself just once here. We sang Close to You in choir in sixth grade at School 84. So I will always associate that song with a girl I had a crush on who was in the same choir in sixth grade. But then what about you guys?
I love that. Amy, you go first.
I remember it on the radio for sure, being in the car, on the radio at home, and all of those big hits. And I've been performing since I was a wee one. And I am an alto. So as I'm listening to it on the radio, and they're so singable, you know, all these songs in many ways are so, the melodies are so singable. But also, I felt like, you know, probably as a kid, I was trying to impersonate Karen because I was like, oh, I can sing in the same range. I can sing just like that. And that drew me to her because, as I say in the show, she's the goat of alto voices. And so she just, you know, was a goddess to me in that sense of like, oh, this is somebody who sort of sings like I do.
But there's also something about the quality of the production of the songs. We need to also talk about in the show about how Richard Carpenter was very progressive and was experimenting with things, just like other artists of the day, Brian Wilson and George Martin and Beatles and others. So he was doing things in the recording studio, especially that multi-layered tracking, voice tracking. So any recording backup singers is all them. It's all their voices just being layered. So there's something really attractive about that sound, or it was to me anyway. And also, they're like storytelling. They're little storytelling songs. It's not like rock and roll, which I love. But at that time, this was sort of an alternative to that. And then later on, when I watched the Karen Carpenter story on television, Mason, and I learned more about her tragic end. And like, it kind of brought this mystery to that. And the longing in her voice became more poignant. Like, it just, there's something about the sound and the quality of her voice that draws you in.
Brent, what about Richard Carpenter? I mean, there were a lot of entertainers on TV, right? When we were growing up, everybody had a variety show. We saw a lot of people playing piano, but he really stood out as an accompanist. I mean, is that something that you latched onto as a kid?
A little bit. Yeah, I do play piano, and that's what I do for a living. So yes, I didn't know a lot about him, and not many people did. She was the front. She was the voice. Even in their television appearances, he was behind her. He's back with the band, although he was the one pulling all the strings and arranging all the songs and all of that. But you don't know a lot about Richard. In the past few years, I've looked more into him and done some research. There was actually a book, a big coffee table book released a couple of years ago that he collaborated on, and he spilled all the beans to everybody. He went into his basement, pulled out all the archives. But it's kind of a recluse. He doesn't really tour, you know, but what he does is he goes into the recording studio and remasters these recordings. He had such an admiration and maybe a little obsession with her voice. And when he lost her, when she was gone, and, you know, we lost all of that great music that could have been, that's what he did. He keeps it up. They've released albums in the last 5 or 6 years. One in particular they did with the London Philharmonic Orchestra, where he added a bunch of new orchestrations to flesh out their already great arrangements. So it's out there still, and he's around, and he's championing the music, but you don't really hear a lot about him. So what I could say to your question is, probably in the back of my mind, I was like, oh, that guy, this is a piano and I am getting into playing piano. And he's sort of a genius and he's a brilliant pianist. I mean, I am not on his level by any stretch of the imagination.
So, Brent, I think you mentioned you guys met at Ball State in the theater and dance program. And if I remember this right, Brent, you had already been through the program, but you were back working for the department.
Yes, I'm a little older than Amy is. Yes, I graduated in 92 and she graduated in 95. So.
In 95, yeah, but you were still there.
Yeah,
you were still
like a year.
Yeah, like a year.
I did linger, as it were. I did get hired and worked on some projects with the department and made more friends, including Amy Brown.
Yeah, as happens in theater schools, a very tight-knit group of people came out of that program at about the same time. And you were in school with Bill Jenkins, who was he a directing student at the time?
Yeah.
I think acting major. But
directing major didn't exist then, but it does now.
But did a lot of directing then.
And he has gone on to become the chair of the department.
Right. And then he directed the show.
Correct.
So when did you bring him in for this?
It was 2021. We developed it. So Bill came on as a director. And we were developing it with the Cabaret Indianapolis. With Shannon Frisell and the team there. They have a program called the Incubator Program, where they work with new artists on a cabaret show. And the Cabaret and Ball State have a connection because there's a class at Ball State that focuses on cabaret, and they do their show in Indianapolis every year. So there's that connection. And so we got connected to Shannon and the Cabaret to develop it. We brought Bill on, you know, to direct, because like any live art form, you really do need a director. You need that set of eyes. You need somebody guiding, asking questions. You know, it's a really, I mean, I guess I can only speak for us, highly collaborative process.
Yeah. And it helps when creating a piece, you got to cut, you got to streamline, you got to narrow it down, you got to make it slick. And that's a part of what the director does as well. And Bill's a master at that because, like you said, he does have that class at Ball State. I did another cabaret at the Cabaret with Shannon in their incubator series. We kind of launched that with Claire Wiltshire back in 2016. So I already had that relationship. I've known Shannon for years and years. And she is a huge, huge support of emerging cabaret artistry. She feels that there's a space in the world for the art form and wants more people to know about it because not a lot of people do, and they don't understand necessarily what it is. So the more we can do it, the better, you know.
Amy, what did you do after you left Ball State?
I went back to Chicago for a couple of years, which is where I'm from originally. And then I went to grad school.
We lived together in Chicago. Too.
Yes, we were roommates in Chicago, too. So we have a long, long, long history. Then I got my MFA in acting at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln and came back to Chicago and worked professionally there for a few years before I moved to New York and have had, as you said, a wide ranging 20 years here of arts administration, performing, producing. But yeah, I've now been in New York for 20 years.
Remind me, Brent, what have you been doing?
Well, I have been working for the Booth Tarkin Civic Theater for about 25 years now, a little over actually. And that is where I've spent the majority of my time. I did, as I mentioned, Amy and I lived in Chicago for about a year together before she went to grad school. And then I ended up coming back and I've been directing the education programming at Civic since 2002. And I've been music directing with them since 1998. So lots of shows there. And I also work around the community with many other companies. So I freelance. You may have seen me.
Let's take a quick break so we can hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
Taft, today's modern law firm. With more than 800 attorneys in 8 primary Midwest markets and the District of Columbia, we provide solutions to the business issues facing middle market and emerging companies alike. We do this through a highly collaborative and inclusive team approach. Taft, the modern law firm. To learn more, visit taftlaw.com.
Okay, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast and our conversation with Amy Raffa and Brent Marty, creators of The Carpenters Project.
Amy, did I get this right? I mean, at some point you took a break from performing maybe even a pronounced break. You know, for people that who are trained in this and who love it and then have to make that decision, tell me how you arrived at that.
So I went back to Chicago after undergrad, and then I went back to Chicago again after my time in Lincoln, Nebraska, and did work professionally. And for folks who may or may not know, you know, you got to work some day jobs, you got to pay some, you know, not necessarily every acting or performing gig pays enough to pay the bills. And I was just starting out, you know, it was very early career. So honestly, I was really like working 7 days a week between acting jobs and my day jobs. And it's the hustle. And I just thought, gosh, this is a lot. And I'm not sure if I have the stamina to continue like this for however long it might be before I could just make my living from acting. And it's a calculation I would imagine many people, you know, have to make. So the calculation I made was, let me move away from acting for the moment. Let me just see what happens if I just perhaps pursue a non-performing path. Let's see what happens. And as it turns out, my roommate from Ball State had been living in New York, and she called me and she said, hey, my roommate's moving. Do you want to move to New York? So it's funny to be thinking about moving away from performing and yet move to New York City, right? Which is in many ways, you know, the heart and soul of theater. But I did. And I worked for a talent agency. I worked for Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts, which is the premier performing arts center in the world, but in non-performing capacities. So arts administration, producing, talent management, HR. I have a long history in HR with it. And because I was working on the other side of the arts, it was important to me, even though I wasn't performing, it was important for me to continue working some way in the arts. And so that was fulfilling for, you know, many, many, many years. And then really like sort of unexpectedly, the itch came back. And our carpenter's idea is something that Brent and I have been talking about really for probably almost a decade. But, you know, in the way that many people do of like, oh, haha, wouldn't it be great, you know, to do this, like do that, you know, that carpenter's idea we've been talking about. And because we don't live in the same city anymore, it would be when we would get together for events or, you know, birthdays or some kind of, you know, friend thing. And we're like, oh, gosh, yeah, we really should pursue that idea. Ha, 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 ha. But then for me, I would say 2018, 2019, the itch really came back in a big way to do something creative. But I really wasn't sure what that was until I finally just said, well, we have this idea. So let's pursue this carpenter's thing and let's see what happens with that. And that has not necessarily, it has satisfied the itch, but what it has made me do is go, gosh, I really want to do more now.
I think it's interesting, Amy, that you wanted to be close to artistry no matter what you were doing. I think most artists feel that way, and often they don't have the opportunity to do that. I'm very fortunate that I have a position here in this city that is sort of permanent, been permanent for me, and that it's sustaining. But that was not my original goal, you know, to be the director of music and education at the Booth Tarkin Civic Theater was not on my resume, you know, or in my goals, but it has fulfilled me. It has kept me in touch. And I do have the luxury of getting to perform pretty often, which is nice.
So doing a cabaret show in the heart of Broadway, this is like a lifetime top of the mountain dream for a lot of people in music theater. But like from a functional standpoint, how do you get booked for these shows?
Oh, it's all about
I mean, I just can't show up in New York with like my one-man show and just get booked.
Well, it is a little bit about who you know, but it's also about being really aggressive looking around, and which Amy is really good at. I being stuck here in the Midwest a little bit, don't have quite the opportunity, but all you have to do is start making phone calls. Am I right, Amy?
Yeah. I mean, self-producing is not for the faint of heart. I mean, That is what we are doing, Mason. I mean, we are self-producing.
We don't have an agent. We don't have a manager. We don't have a producer.
It's a different kind of hustle. I mean, now we're hustling like our little show that could, but it is calling. It's asking folks for introduction, folks that we know that maybe have worked at a venue. Could you introduce us to the booker? you know, these venues do have bookers, but at least in New York City, I can't speak for everywhere else that we will eventually go to, but in New York City, there's a certain model to the cabaret venues where some folks, I wouldn't say that they require an audition, but you do have to meet with them. They may want to see some kind of clip of what you've done. But as long as you can get, not to sound crude, butts in seats, they'll book you because the model now for cabaret, and this is not the case at the cabaret in Indianapolis. You know, Shannon Frisell and the team there, it's a different way. It's a different way of booking. But in New York City, there's so many cabaret venues that it's fairly easy to get booked, but you have to get butts in seats because they're requiring a certain amount of folks for their revenue, right?
Right. And you're on the hook if you don't meet that. Yeah.
That's right. They'll split the cover with you. You know, there's usually some kind of formula to splitting the cover, the ticket cover, but then they take the revenue from the food and drink. There's usually a food and drink minimum. So that's very specific in New York City, and it may be other ways as well. So the booking perhaps isn't as tricky because then it's more you've got to market it in order to get the butts in seats.
Right. So the fact that we can say, yes, we played these venues, which, you know, anybody could call and get a booking, but we sold them out. That is what people would look at. They were looking to book you. Oh, well, you sold this out. Okay. People are interested in what you're doing.
Are there any issues with using the songs? I mean, do you need to get permission from Richard Carpenter or pay royalties or something?
That's a really good question. Yes, there are laws that cover live performance of other people's material, even though you may be doing them in your own way. But all of these venues that we play have an ASCAP license, which is the Union for Composers and Writers of Music, which covers your royalties. So they pay a fee to ASCAP. The venues pay a fee to ASCAP. BMI is the other half of that. Mm-hmm. And that, like, we do that at Civic Theater as well. So if we're presenting a cabaret or we're or using music in our classrooms, we have licensure because we pay that fee. And then the unions distribute the fees to the artists, just like a Spotify does or YouTube or anything like that. So we don't have to really deal with it, but you have to be aware of it. You can't just run amok.
Right, right.
Because you could get shut down or sued. You don't want that.
Which songs in the show are more resonant for you today than they were when you were younger?
Rainy Days and Mondays, for sure. That may be the number one resonant for me now as an adult.
The opening line, talking to myself and feeling old.
Talking to myself and feeling old. That's the first line. And, you know, life experience, the comedy and tragedy of life. Certainly those lyrics mean something to me. They're more meaningful now, for sure.
Yeah, I think you could probably say that about most of their songs because they do speak to that. Again, it's that certain longing or that wanting, that unrequited love, you know, all the things that you didn't know as a kid or as a young person that now you do as an old person. They all sort of resonate. I don't know if there's one particular. I mean, I love Superstar. It's just a brilliant recording and we stick pretty closely to what that original recording is. And there's a reason for that. It's because it's priceless. And as we tell on the show, she nailed that recording in one take. So it's almost like it is a live performance when you're listening to it. But again, the melancholy there is very, I don't know if appealing is the right word, but, you know, it speaks to me, it speaks to people.
Long ago, and so far away, I fell in love with you before the second show. Your guitar, it sounds so sweet and clear, but you're not really here. It's just the radio. Don't you remember you told me you love me, baby? You said you'd be coming back this way again.
So to this point, I mean, what, and you can answer this separately, what has this show meant to you?
Well, oh my God.
I don't cry, Rafa.
I know. I'm a crier, Mason. I'm a crier.
Well, for me, it is a chance to revisit some of this music and present it and share it. That's one of the reasons I love cabaret, is sharing this music with an audience that may love it or may not know it at all, and get that symbiotic thing going with the audience that way, as an artist, as a performer. But it's also been a wonderful chance to work with a dear friend and put something together that's meaningful for people. At the end of the show, it is an emotional release. And we end the show saying thank you in a song. It's really, you know, and I'm not going to cry. That sort of, it just leaves a great feeling with me in particular to share this particular music.
All the things Brent said, you know, it's a fact, working not only with Brent, but with Bill, with Shannon and her team, working with people that I love very much and have known and loved for a long time, and it being collaborative, the opportunity to come back to performing honestly and truly, not really not thinking that that would happen again, number one, but number two, in an art form that I didn't also necessarily think about either, really. I mean, I love cabaret and I go to cabaret, but I wasn't necessarily going, oh, at this point in my life, I will become a cabaret artist. So it's been wonderfully surprising to explore this music that we love so much in this kind of art form. And it has, frankly, lit a fire in me to go, well, what can we do next? What can we work on next in this format? And then the audience, I mean, like I said, you know, earlier in our conversation, the friend who grew up with this music, hearing people in the audience, you can hear the audible recognition, the emotion, and having that really intimate shared experience with them. It's just been an enormous gift.
It is a gift. And people have moments in their lives that a particular Carpenter song may define. It may define that moment in their lives. And a lot of pop music is that way. Music just does that in general. But that's what Amy's saying. People go, oh, I got engaged to that song. Or I lost my friend. And when this song came on, it triggered something, you know. So it is, there are moments of that. And like, I think that is particular to some of this music.
So yeah, where do you want to take this next? Brent, you mentioned something about the West Coast.
Well, you know, we're just, every time I'm in New, if I'm traveling to New York, I'm like, Amy, find a spot. We'll do it. So, but I don't know. Like, yes, we have friends all over this country, you know, whether it's Ball State Connection or otherwise. And when we post on Facebook or whatever about the show, they're like, bring it here, bring it here. So, you know, LA, Portland, Seattle, Vegas, think we're going to get a booking in Evansville, Indiana, maybe this summer sometime. So if anybody is out there and wants to book us, please get in touch. We will take it wherever we can.
Is there a chance you would come back to Carmel or Indianapolis anytime?
Oh, I hope so. I hope so. Because again, either want to see it again or haven't seen it yet. And I get that all the time. When are you bringing it back? So yeah, I assume we'll be back either at Feinstein's or maybe at the Cabaret one day.
I just want to thank you guys for sharing these stories with me. This is fantastic. And I certainly hope it does come back to Indianapolis so I can check it out.
Yes. Thank you, Mason. What a pleasure.
Thank you, really. This was a real treat.
My thanks again to Brent and Amy. And folks, before you get on with the rest of your week, there are a few stories in the latest issue of IBJ I want to draw to your attention. First up, dozens of music events are locked in for a particularly packed summer concert season in Central Indiana. But Wonder Road and All In, two multiple-day festivals that debuted in 2022 and returned in 2023, have not announced plans for 2024. Dave Lindquist takes stock of the summer calendar. Also in this week's issue, John Russell has the story on the activist investor that's pushing for big changes at Elanco Animal Health, including the CEO's ouster and a board shakeup. And Daniel Bradley has more on the fight in Carmel over park impact fees that are charged to developers and used to support park construction. And again, you can find these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at ibj.com. And thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.